This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
That's why today our government tabled the Protecting Privacy and Consumer Data Act. The new bill gives Canadians more control over their personal information, gives them the right to deletion against deepfakes. It protects children's information as sensitive. It takes aim at surveillance pricing to stop price gouging. So why do we need this now? Canada's consumer privacy laws are 25 years old. They were written before the iPhone. It was a different time, before AI, before deepfakes. And because so much of our lives right now, especially our kids' lives, have been shaped by platforms, apps, and digital services, we're living in a different world. And our laws need to catch up. That's why this bill gives the regulator real power to enforce the law. Many have called for this.
That was AI Minister Evan Solomon last month introducing Bill C-36, the much-anticipated privacy reform bill. You heard Solomon refer to the privacy regulator, but what he doesn't say in the clip is that the regulator he's thinking of isn't the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. That's because the bill envisions stripping the Privacy Commissioner of responsibility for private sector privacy law and shifting it to the Digital Safety Commission, which would be renamed the Digital Safety and Data Protection Commission. That change may be the most important part of the bill and would reshape privacy law in Canada. I've been critical of the approach, but wanted to hear from someone who has experience in the Privacy Commissioner role. That someone is David Lucadelis, who has over 35 years of experience in privacy and freedom of information matters. He served as BC's Information and Privacy Commissioner from 1999 to 2010, where he was responsible for enforcement of BC's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act and the Personal Information Protection Act, which came into force in 2004. From 2010 to 2012, David was BC's Deputy Attorney General and Deputy Minister of Justice. He joins me on the podcast to share his thoughts on the enforcement changes in Bill C-36 and what they may mean for privacy in Canada. David, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks very much, Michael. It's great to hear your voice.
Yeah, no, it's really good to see you. It's been some time. And I'm really glad that you've taken the time to come on because I think, you know, you provide a perspective that few in the country have when it comes to privacy. You served as BC's Information and Privacy Commissioner from 1999 to 2010, independent officer of the legislature, had order-making power, and then you served as BC's Deputy Attorney General. I know you've had a number of other really important roles along the way, or at least since, but you know, for our purposes today, you've sat in both the independent watchdog's chair and also in a senior government chair advising ministers. And the talk around Bill C-36, Canada's privacy reform bill, beyond the modernization on the substance side, has really been the changes to the enforcement and the stripping of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada's authority over private sector privacy and the creation of a new Digital Safety and Data Protection Commission. I want to get into the details and your thoughts on the impact will be, but really just first, you know, what was your first reaction when you heard about the proposed change?
Well, I think like a lot of people, Michael, my initial reaction was, I was gobsmacked, frankly. My initial reaction was that it's counterproductive. It's wasteful. It's impractical in terms of what it implies for the Office of the Privacy Commissioner and what's being proposed with this new, you know, Digital Safety and Data Protection Commission and the subcommission and the subcommissioner, if I could put it that way. It's a greenfield exercise. It's going to take a long time to get this organization up and running. It will require that they acquire subject matter and regulatory expertise. That's no small matter. They'll need to establish good working relationships within government and within industry and business in Canada, but also with their peers, both domestic and international. And of course, the implications for the Office of the Privacy Commissioner are immense. It could well lead to the evisceration of that office. And so that's that. On those grounds alone, I found myself initially reacting, say, why do this? What's the policy benefit of this? And I couldn't identify any. That said, I think my second reaction was, the real point here, it seems to me, is to enhance the role and power of the executive branch of government, both elected and appointed. For one thing, the absence, we could talk about this more, of security of tenure. These are going to be cabinet appointees serving at pleasure. Removal for cause is really not a much of a safeguard in my view when it comes to these kinds of roles. The advancement and protection of a fundamental right of privacy. There's no role for parliament, no transparency or accountability for the proposed new commission and commissioner. And I think that's intentional. The ministerial role in setting policy and guidance, I think, makes that obvious. Section 77 of the bill, or of the what would be the statute if passed, is another indicator of that. It would require the commission and the commissioner to consider the importance of economic growth and competition and innovation in the Canadian marketplace, the importance of respecting Canada's international trade obligations. These are all, I think, indicators that what government's seeking to do here is to exert a greater degree of control and to see privacy as really just one aspect of a digital strategy. So, all of those things could be given as in terms of a mandate to the privacy commissioner without creating this new organization. So again, bottom line, I think it's a wasteful and counterproductive initiative. And I think it's important for government to reverse course and not tack this immensely important responsibility onto the already diffuse and complicated mandates that are being proposed for this new commission.
Yeah, no, there definitely is a lot of complexity there. We've had some opportunities to talk a bit about C-34 and just how complex it is, even just on the online harm side. You're right, layering in privacy brings with it a lot. Now, I want to drill down on several of the points you just made. Why don't we start with independence? Privacy Committee of Canada is an agent of Parliament. As you mentioned, C-36 replaces that with a cabinet designated member who will be part of a five-person commission. Chair and the majority are focused really on the online content, digital safety issues. Now, having held an independent officer role yourself, practically from a day-to-day perspective, what is independence by a privacy regulator that the cabinet-appointed commissioner wouldn't have?
I think there are a couple of key points there, in terms of what independence brings. But I guess to start off, what does independence not mean? It does not mean that as an independent officer of parliament or of a legislature, that you have free run. I mean, independence brings responsibility, obviously, to take the job seriously, to be accountable for what you do, to do the work, get stuck in, if you will. And it does not mean, independence does not mean you can run rogue, ignore the proper limits of your authority. It's not a license to interpret or apply the law to suit your own policy preferences. And it certainly does not mean that you can burn bridges either with your staff, government officials, or peers elsewhere. You have to be politic and diplomatic and thoughtful, or you're going to end up alienating everyone, including policymakers and public servants and legislators. And if you do that, my experience shows from observing, other independent officers, including in British Columbia, that government stops listening very quickly. So what you might think is the bully pulpit that independence brings you to speak out about policy issues, really becomes a hollow thing, if you will, because again, people just stop listening to you and you cease to have any influence. What independence does mean, of course, is that you have the freedom to speak and act independently and thoughtfully, going to the point I was just trying to make. If you do so with apparent knowledge, and if you say things that are reasonable, you'll acquire authority both publicly but also within government, and your views will carry weight in counterbalance to what government's saying or proposing as a policy initiative. And that can go a long way in helping to shape policy, whether the discussions are internal and private with government or frankly in public, including by appearing in front of a legislative committee. So, another thing that independence obviously brings is in making decisions about specific cases or complaints, you don't need to worry about the direct impact on your own employment. There's meaningful protection against government or business unhappiness about a specific outcome. You might get lobbied against. Businesses might come to government and say, we don't like this decision, but that doesn't then directly and immediately threaten your employment. You have a real freedom there to do what's right, according to the law.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Let me put what I believe is the government's strongest argument, or what I think they have in mind. You said, you started initial reaction. What are they thinking here? One reading of this bill, and my colleague Teresa Scazza makes this case, is what they are thinking about is that a government that was never really comfortable with an independent agent of parliament holding both order-making power and the penalty powers over the private sector. You know, in the last bill, they put forward a tribunal effectively as a mechanism to try to address that. Now, of course, you exercised exactly that kind of power in BC for years. And so what are your thoughts on the government's concerns here? Is there reason for concern about an independent officer wielding that kind of binding enforcement power, or is that frankly how the model ought to be working?
I think there's arguably a backstory to this that could justify somebody seeing this as a specifically Ottawa concern, if you will. I think there's, in a relatively distant past, some concerns, some history about decisions made by independent officers. I think, based on my own experience in BC, that those concerns are misplaced. There are plenty of checks and balances in place. The independence of a decision maker is, in my view, not itself the concern directly. I mean, if independence of a decision maker were a concern, then I think government and industry should be worried about the courts. I mean, the judicial branch of government and their independence, the independence of judges. I think historically the concern has been about the desire of some in the business community not to be on the receiving end of meaningful enforcement, preferring the so-called ombuds model that, brings no binding remedies, just findings and recommendations. Because that's frankly just easier. Even though in other spheres of activity, if you will, businesses are subject to, not just from the courts, binding orders and remedies. So it's a bit of an odd thing that might be specific to the office in the past, I should emphasize. And in BC, look, you have order-making power, you have binding remedies, but those are the exception. In the public and private sector, most disputes, most complaints are resolved through mediation and recommendations to government or to private sector actors. But you need the backstop, I think, of binding remedies or penalties to make that work. You have the stick out there if it's needed and if it's applied judiciously. And look, if you're worried about the independence of the decision maker, the courts are there to control that risk. And this legislation through internal commission mechanisms and, as I understand it, the de novo review role of the federal court are there to guard against mistakes or abuse in an extreme case. So I think what governments need to do is have confidence in independent decision makers, hire them well through a transparent and meaningful process, preferably parliamentary, and then let the courts and parliament do the rest. Let them hold independent decision makers properly to account.
Yeah. Now, you might have hinted this off the top, but Bill C-36, as we know, doesn't abolish the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. It just narrows it back to the Public Sector Privacy Act. This feels a bit like 1998 all over again for that office. From your experience running an office that addressed both public and private, what happens to, do you think, to an institution that has at least half of its mandate carved out? What happens to the people, to the expertise, to the standing of the office when you see this kind of change take place?
This is, I think, a real concern. I'm deeply worried about what this means for the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. It, will really lead to the hollowing out of a large part, not just of its mandate, but potentially of the office, frankly. I mean, the Privacy Commissioner, can't expect to control who leaves that office for the new commissioner for other opportunities, frankly. So there's a real risk of serious harm, I think, to the expertise and capacity of that office at a time when, public sector threats to citizens' privacy are certainly not decreasing. There's all kinds of reason to be concerned that we have continue to have a well-resourced, expert regulatory body in the form of the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, and taking away the private sector mandate after, more than 25 years of expertise and experience in that office really threatens, the public sector side of enforcement as well. And that would be one of the great tragedies of this, I think, ill-considered initiative on the part of the government. And, when it comes to public sector privacy, the OPC is internationally respected amongst, peer organizations and stakeholders. It's developed trust and confidence, and this has it. This is something we can talk about in terms of the mandate of the new commission and commissioner. But it's developed trust and confidence on the part of peers and stakeholders around the world, and you'd be risking that, all of that. And again, for what really? Because people will be looking at the office after this happens and asking, how well is it going to be able to continue to, deliver on that public sector mandate, at least in the medium term, for sure.
Yeah, no, I want to come back to those kinds of issues around the relationship and such between the office and other offices, both international and domestic. Before we do that, I did want to get your thoughts on essentially how the government seems to be conceiving of privacy, right? By moving it into this commission built to really police online harms and say that it is really, this is where privacy belongs. It's essentially all about digital safety. Is something being lost, do you think, by making that kind of shift? When I thought of privacy, I often thought of things that have a digital component but aren't really digital at its core, whether that's banking or airlines, insurers, hospitals, retailers, many, all of whom now, of course, have a digital component, but privacy is it seems to me a whole lot bigger than AI and just digital. What are, do you think, some of the implications of essentially reconceiving of privacy primarily through the digital lens, at least in terms of how the government seeks to enforce the rules?
First of all, I fully agree with you that tacking, if you will, privacy onto the other mandates of the proposed regulator is ill-conceived. I think it's possibly even you could describe it as a distortion of what privacy is all about. It does see it, I think, as being about online activity, digital activity in that sense, whether it's social media or what have you. And it's much more than that. And this legislation would apply in large parts of the country to large, sectors of economic activity in Ontario, for example, at least, in the short term, that may have a digital component, as you said, but are not about online activity. They're not about digital, if you will, in that sense. And so it misconceives what privacy is all about. And then by forcing it in, wedging it into this broader mandate, which is really a mishmash of important but disparate roles, I think that you risk losing focus on this fundamental right of ours, which has constitutional implications, certainly in public activity. You miss losing focus, or you risk losing focus on that, and it could well suffer in the mix, right? It really is an enhanced risk, I think, too, because again, the commission is meant to be there to support Canadian business and competitiveness, and these are admirable policy goals, of course, important goals. But in that context, privacy could in fact be forced into the back seat. That's a big concern, I think.
Yeah. All right. So I've been teeing you up for a lot of criticism. Before we shift to sort of how this will work and some of the relationship implications with federal, with provincial commissioners, with data protection commissioners and privacy commissioners around the world, is there a defensible version of what we're doing here? Do you see some benefits in terms of that? There may be costs and risks, and you've highlighted a bunch, but are there some benefits that you could see taking place, or from your perspective, this is just an own goal, so to speak, in terms of where the government's going?
Well, to flip it around, I mean, I have to acknowledge that, of course, privacy these days is, very much, digitally mediated, if you will. The implications of, online activity are significant for privacy, absolutely. And so I suppose you could argue that combining, privacy oversight and enforcement in this sort of super commission that has these other aspects of digital issues that touch on privacy in part, that there's a benefit to that. You're consolidating that in one place. I don't know that that's a sufficiently important objective or outcome to overcome some of the concerns that I've expressed. You, I suppose, could argue that there's also efficiency in combining the enforcement aspects as well, both in terms of just costs, but also consistency of regulatory activity. On the other hand, you're not getting rid of the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. It may end up being a much reduced organization, but it's still there. And so if you're going to make an argument for administrative efficiency, I think you have to face up to that fact. So I don't know. At the end of the day, sure, there might be some benefits, but for myself, I'm just not persuaded that government's made that case, certainly not persuasively, and that any harms are outweighed.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, the Federal Privacy Commissioner and provincial co privacy commissioners have been working, think increasingly closely together. I mean, there was always, of course, efforts to try to bring them together on policy issues and meet on a regular basis. But we've seen even more and more of it in recent years. Part of it sometimes felt like the federal commissioner leveraging some of the powers that the federal commissioner didn't have to combine a bit with the provincial commissioners. Any thoughts on how this is going to affect those kinds of relationship? There's obviously, as I say, longstanding federal-provincial architecture. There's the substantial similarity designations with the provinces. What does all this mean in a country where we don't have just one privacy statute? We've got many of them, and we also have many privacy commissioners all across the country.
No, I like to think, and I'm quite confident that the, well, it's going to be interesting to see how things work out at the FPT table. And I'd like to think that there will continue to be good working relationships, good communication, good coordination on policy and guidance, and even on individual investigations, as you've just alluded to. So I don't think offhand that a cabinet-appointed body or commissioner, can't, make that work, and that, provincial and territorial colleagues won't be willing to make it work. And obviously there'd be some need to, gain familiarity with the new commissioner and the commission and how it works. But I do think that, there could be successful ongoing cooperation and coordination. I guess one issue might be, certainly in the early days, that if you have a commission of, let's just say, two commissioners, one of whom is designated as the lead commissioner showing up at the FPT table, that there might be some questions in the minds of the provincial and territorial commissioners, regulators, about what happens when these two, again, assuming there's only two of them, go back to Ottawa and sort of report back to the larger commission. Will the message be heard? Will it be the case that what they've agreed to, let's say, at the table with provincial territorial counterparts actually, ends up being put into place? That's perhaps one issue that might have to be negotiated.
Okay, and that's interesting. Thinking about how there are sort of multiple players coming into that role. What about on the international side? It does seem to me that the federal commissioners, we can think back to, of course, Jennifer Stoddart or many others that have played real global roles when it comes to many of these issues. So a strong global standing. There is similarly regular meetings that take place between privacy commissioners, data protection commissioners around the world. How might this affect how we're viewed internationally, both in terms of the change, but also the independence? What other implications might there be?
Well, yeah, one of the international implications, possible international implications, actually, puts me in mind of an issue that and you alluded to this, and I should address it first, if I may. But this question about substantial similarity, where under PIPEDA, and it will be the case under the new legislation, are the private sector privacy laws that exist in the provinces, BC, Alberta, Quebec, are they substantially similar to the federal legislation, so that the federal legislation doesn't, kind of purport to preempt them, and it's a cabinet decision ultimately. And I think this legislation, including given the changes to the nature and mandate of the oversight body, I think, you're going to have to open up that question, I think, again. And setting aside the what I've always thought is the extraordinarily cheeky nature of that whole exercise, where cabinet, the federal cabinet, is pleased to bless a provincial law that's otherwise valid. That's a question that's going to have to be addressed, I think, and will take some communications with federal between federal and the provincial and territorial regulatory bodies and governments. Internationally, it's I mentioned this earlier. I think it's going to take years for this new oversight body to gain the respect and trust and confidence of their international peers, particularly or notably in the EU. The OPC has for some time now had a very, very high reputation and standing internationally. I believe the current commissioner, Philippe Dufresne, is the chair of the Global Privacy Assembly of Privacy Regulators, and continues to have the trust and confidence of his peers. But this is an unnecessary, I think, risk that the government's taking here. The new commissioner couldn't expect just to show up at the international table and have people say, "Oh, good, the Canadians are back. That's great. Let's just carry on." It's going to take time for that organization to demonstrate, that they deserve the ongoing trust and confidence in the international community. But I think there's a concrete risk here about the legal exposure this creates for the adequacy ruling under the EU's GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. I don't know that ultimately these changes would lead to Canada losing that adequacy status, but what it means is that that's going to be open to debate, I think, open to question, and it creates a real and I think unnecessary risk, because if we don't continue to have adequacy in terms of the sort of equivalency, if you will, with the GDPR, it puts at risk the ongoing data flows between Canada and Europe. And the perversity of that is that it's at odds with the government's desire to diversify trade away from the US and the bill's own stated recognition of the importance of supporting economic growth, competition, and innovation, because, commerce depends increasingly on the flows of personal data. So, that's obviously a risk that's being would be presented by this bill in terms of the attitude of the Europeans as to whether or not we're up to snuff on the independence front, amongst other things, in terms of compliance with the adequacy ruling that's already in place.
Yeah, can you just, given those risks, can you just unpack that a little more for those that aren't fully familiar with what the adequacy finding means and the implications, and I guess particularly why changing the regulator, as opposed to looking at the substance of the law, but changing the regulator and removing some of the independence might have implications for Canada standing there.
Yeah, sorry, Michael. So the General Data Protection Regulation is a law of the European Union, applies throughout all of the economies of the EU. And as I recall, the European Union has the third largest economy in the world. And as I mentioned, a lot of commerce these days is, depends on the flows of personal data. And that includes data flows across borders. And the GDPR regulates that and provides a key mechanism, which is adequacy. So there has to be a ruling on the part of the Data Protection Board of commissioners within the EU that is adopted by the Commission ultimately, that says that another country's law, data protection or privacy law, is adequate, i.e., that it lines up well enough with the protections under the GDPR, such that that other country is qualified to send or receive data. Because otherwise, there could be a complete there can be a wall put up by the European Union that would prevent those flows of data. So for banking, insurance, other financial services, if a Canadian company wanted to establish operations in the EU and we no longer had that adequacy ruling, that could impose barriers in terms of the flow of Canadian or European customers' data back and forth. So it's an important thing. And the changes to the independence of the regulator under this proposed legislation, it seems to me, could well raise the risk, a risk to that ruling. And it will certainly, I think, trigger a review of that ruling, the existing ruling that Canada has under PIPEDA. And that's why I say I don't know why we would risk that at a time when we're trying to, increase trade with countries in the European Union.
Yeah. No, and I think that's a question a lot of people are asking. Why don't we close here? A different version of this bill, I think, could have given the existing commissioner order-making power, cleaner separation of functions if we needed, without dismantling the independent side of things. And so if our goal is a modern, well-enforced privacy law, and I think everybody agrees that that really ought to be the objective, what do you think ought to come next? If you were asked to appear before a committee, let's assume C36 is going to head to committee, and they're studying this bill, what are the one or two changes that you'd be pushing the hardest for?
I would ask the committee to report to government. I'd ask government, in fact, just scrap it. Don't pack privacy onto the mandate of this new commission. Just reverse course. I think it's not good policy. I think what ought to happen, as has been clearly necessary for decades, and you allude to this, is to update PIPEDA. Keep the mandate for enforcement with the Privacy Commissioner of Canada and the Commissioner's office. Give the tools to that office that are needed, enforcement powers, meaningful, oversight, needed to oversee privacy in the modern private sector in Canada. So basically, yeah, just reverse course. Don't do it. Give all of that power and authority to the commissioner under the existing legislation under PIPEDA.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a sort of a clean solution in terms of a straightforward way to try to get that done. Certainly the reaction from many in the privacy community, I think, has been consistent with that really puzzlement that a bill that otherwise kind of coming at the end of what has been a very long process, or potentially at the end of a very long process, meets a lot of the expectations and needs, and then suddenly you get this curveball that really changes how people, I think, evaluate the bill as a whole.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you for taking the time, providing a perspective. That I say it's one thing for academics or others to talk about what it's actually like to be a privacy commissioner. It's something else entirely to have one who's actually had the job and had the job for many, many years in a really high profile way. So thank you for the years of work on privacy, and in particular, thanks for joining me here on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for the work you do, your op-ed pieces and your Substack articles and so much more. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. It's good to see you too.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.